Welcome to the Federal News Update Evening Edition for Friday, October 17th, 2025. I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy.
So our mission for this deep dive, it's really driven by your request for a really comprehensive, exhaustive, and granular look at what the U.S. federal government has been doing since the start of October 16th.
Yeah, and it's been an incredibly active couple of days. Really turbulent.
Okay, definitely turbulent. And that turbulence, it seems defined by this ongoing government shutdown, right? How long has it been now?
We're deep into day 17 as of today, Friday the 17th.
17 days. Wow.
And, you know, the usual thinking is shutdown means everything stops, stagnation.
Yeah.
But what we're seeing here is almost the opposite. The legislative paralysis, it's acting like an accelerant.
An accelerant?
How so?
Well, because Congress can't act, the executive branch is pushing through major policy using unilateral actions. We're talking big moves on healthcare, energy, even reshaping the entire civil service. Right. And it's not happening in a vacuum. This assertion of executive power, it's hitting some serious resistance.
Exactly. It feels like a government in conflict with itself. Congress is bypassed, so things get done through these sometimes backroom deals, sometimes just raw institutional power plays.
Yeah.
Almost like political punishment in some cases.
Okay, so let's start with Capitol Hill then, because that gridlock, it sounds like it's not just continuing, it's hardening, becoming a weapon.
That's absolutely the right way to put it. This shutdown isn't an accident anymore. It feels like a chosen state of conflict. Yesterday, October 16th, Senate Democrats voted down the House-passed continuing resolution H.R. 5371 for the 10th time.
The 10th time.
10th time. That just shows a complete breakdown in the most basic legislative function, you know, keeping the government funded.
And the Democrats under Senator Schumer, they're being pretty upfront about their demands, aren't they?
Oh, completely. They're tying any funding bill, even a short-term stopgap measure, to extending those enhanced subsidies under the Affordable Care Act, the ACA subsidies that are about to expire.
And that's not a minor ask. Schumer's framing it as a looming healthcare crisis, right? Millions seeing premium spikes.
Exactly. He's saying without these subsidies, premiums could jump dramatically, potentially kicking millions off their insurance. So it's their core leverage point.
And they're holding firm on everything, even defense funding.
That's the really striking part. They blocked a procedural vote on the annual defense appropriations bill yesterday. And this is a bill that had huge bipartisan support coming out of committee, passed 26-3, near unanimous.
Wait, blocking funding for the military? That sounds like terrible politics. What's the strategic thinking there? Why risk that on a bill everyone basically agreed on?
Because it creates this unified choke point, you see. By linking defense funding, something Republicans almost never compromise on, to the ACA subsidies, they force the GOP's hand.
So it's choose between paying the troops or giving in on health care.
Pretty much. Senator Thune called it partisan obstruction, obviously, you know, hitting them for not paying the troops. But Democrats, like Senator Murphy, are dug in. They're saying nothing moves, no appropriations bills, until the health care premium issue gets resolved definitively.
Okay, so total legislative paralysis. Right. And that void gets filled by the executive branch, but selectively, picking winners and losers.
Exactly. And we saw that immediately on October 16th. DHS Secretary Kristi Noem made a big announcement, a major exception to the shutdown's financial pain.
Which was?
Over 70,000 federal law enforcement officers, think CBP, Border Patrol, ICE, Secret Service, they're all going to get paid during the shutdown. Full pay.
Full pay during a shutdown? How? That seems unusual.
It's definitely unusual. The move was framed very politically. You know, President Trump and I will always stand by law enforcement. They're set to get a super check by October 22nd, covering all hours, overtime, the next pay period.
Okay, but the mechanism, how are they funding this if appropriations have lapsed? Where's the money coming from? This needs a deeper dive.
Right. And this is where it gets creative, legally speaking. They're using funds from the One Big Beautiful Bill Act.
The reconciliation bill from the summer.
That's the one. Now, reconciliation usually bypasses the filibuster for budget stuff, right? Hmm. But this specific bill gave DHS extra funds, almost like a contingency reserve, or some might call it a slush fund, with very few strings attached, very few spending conditions.
Ah, okay. So they're using those reconciliation funds to sidestep the normal appropriations process, paying their preferred agencies through this kind of emergency budget maneuver.
Precisely. They essentially set up this parallel funding stream months ago, And now it's being deployed to neutralize a key political weak spot, border security and law enforcement going unpaid.
But the selectivity is really stark here, isn't it? And highly political.
Absolutely. The DHS announcement was very specific about who gets paid. Border Patrol agents, ICE officers, Secret Service, air marshals.
And who doesn't get paid?
Well, pointedly excluded are TSA officers.
Yeah.
The reasoning given was they are not law enforcement officers.
Wow.
And crucially, it also excludes other essential CBP employees. The ones who handle customs, facilitate trade at the ports. Vital functions, but not classified as law enforcement for this payment.
So that creates this massive division within DHS itself. I imagine the unions aren't happy.
Well, the National Treasury Employees Union, NTEU, they welcome the pay for the law enforcement folks, sure. But they immediately pointed out that their members, the customs officers, the trade specialists at CBP, are still working without pay. Their jobs are critical for global commerce, keeping goods flowing, but they're deemed non-essential for funding purposes right now.
And this selective payment just highlights the pain for the rest of the federal workforce, doesn't it?
It really does. You have to remember, thousands of civilian federal employees are working without pay. Think about Justice Department lawyers who are actually in court representing the Trump administration. Right now, they're not getting paid.
Right. And Bureau of Prisons employees, I heard many are veterans.
Yes, a significant number are veterans. And they're under immense financial stress. There are reports, you know, cited in the source materials of BOP staff missing paychecks while dealing with huge life events, new babies, car payments due, basic necessities.
Let's pause on that. What are the sources saying about the real world impact? That first full missed paycheck is hitting soon, right? Later this month or next week for many?
The impact is both financial and psychological. Deeply demoralizing. Some accounts mention therapists working with veterans in federal jobs, saying the political conflict just sucked the life out of them.
That's devastating.
Yeah, the stability they thought they had, often after years in the military, it's just been pulled out from under them. Weaponized, really.
And on top of the immediate crisis, there's future anxiety, too, about healthcare costs.
Exactly. Compounding all this, the Office of Personnel Management, OPM, announced that the average premium contribution for the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program, FEHB, is set to jump by 12.3% in 2026.
12.3%? That's huge.
It's the second year in a row of double-digit hikes. So you're working without pay now, and you're looking at a massive increase in your healthcare costs next year.
What's driving that hike?
OPM says it's an aging workforce, more chronic conditions, and especially the high cost and demand for new prescription drugs, like those GLP-1 weight loss drugs.
And while some regional plans might see drops, others are skyrocketing. I saw a mention of one plan.
Yeah, the Specialized Panama Canal Benefit Plan, a staggering 139% increase. It really illustrates the volatility and the pressure these workers are facing. It's a perfect storm. No pay now, huge cost increases looming.
So the executive branch prioritized paying law enforcement and also handled military pay earlier, right?
Correct. That potential political crisis, active duty military going unpaid, was dealt with back on October 15th. President Trump issued National Security Presidential Memorandum 8, NSPM 8.
And that's cited.
Article 2 authority. Basically, inherent presidential power. He directed the Secretary of War and OMB to make sure active duty paychecks went out on time. That neutralized a huge political threat for the administration.
Okay, so the executive finds ways to pay its priorities. The legislature is completely deadlocked. Which brings us to the third branch, the judiciary. What's the status there?
That's where things got really serious today, October 17th. The Administrative Office of the U.S. Courts put out an announcement. Starting Monday, October 20th, the entire federal judiciary runs out of non-appropriated funds.
Runs out completely. What does that mean practically?
It means a systemic crisis. The judicial branch will have to scale back operations dramatically. Only functions deemed absolutely essential to perform its constitutional duties will continue.
So delayed cases, postponed trials.
Exactly. Jury trials likely postponed, civil cases on hold, only the most urgent constitutional matters moving forward. It really elevates the shutdown from a political budget fight into, well, an unprecedented threat to the independent functioning of the judiciary itself, a co-equal branch running on fumes.
And when Congress is paralyzed and the judiciary is hobbled, that just creates this enormous space for the executive branch to act unilaterally, doesn't it? Bypassing the whole legislative process.
Precisely. Which leads us directly into the major policy initiatives pushed through just in the last 2 days.
Starting with healthcare and a pretty significant campaign promise.
Yes, in vitro fertilization, IVF. On October 16th, President Trump announced this multi-part plan aimed at lowering IVF costs and expanding access.
This follows the whole Alabama Supreme Court ruling on frozen embryos earlier this year, right? So politically potent.
Very much so. It was framed explicitly as pro-family, directly addressing the political and legal fallout from that Alabama decision.
Let's get into the mechanics here, because you mentioned this illustrates the policy-by-deal approach. What was the actual deal?
Okay, so the centerpiece was this Most Favored Nation, or MFN-style agreement they struck with EMD Serono. They're a huge pharmaceutical company, a major maker of fertility drugs.
Right. What did EMD Serono agree to?
They agreed to provide Gonal-F, which is one of the most common fertility drugs, and some others, at a really steep discount.
And how would patients get this discount?
The plan is to sell these discounted drugs directly through the administration's upcoming TrumpRx.gov website. That's slated to launch sometime in 2026.
And the claimed savings are substantial.
The White House is claiming savings up to $2,200 per IVF cycle. And the FDA commissioner, Dr. Marty McCarry, gave some specifics too. He said another common therapy that costs around $242 now could drop to as low as $10. So immediate price cuts on existing drugs.
Okay, but as you said, policy by deal. What did EMD Serono get in return for these price cuts? Companies don't usually do this out of altruism.
No, they certainly don't. They got two major regulatory concessions. First, a reprieve from Section 232 tariffs on their imported drug components or finished products.
Okay, tariff relief. What was the second thing?
And this is the big one. A priority review voucher, or PRV, from the FDA.
A priority review voucher. Explain that. Why is that such a big deal for a drug company?
Oh, a PRV is incredibly valuable. It lets a company slash the standard FDA review time for a different new drug. Normally, that's maybe 10 to 12 months. A PRV can cut it down to 6 months.
6 months? That's a huge speed up.
And in this specific deal, it seems even faster. They're using it to accelerate the review of their drug Pergoveris, which is already sold over in Europe. The expectation is review could happen in just 1 or 2 months.
1 or 2 months instead of almost a year. Wow.
Exactly. These vouchers are normally given for drugs targeting rare diseases, sort of as an incentive. And they're actually tradable assets that can be sold to other companies for literally hundreds of millions of dollars.
So EMD Serono got this incredibly valuable fast-track voucher for a drug already approved elsewhere in exchange for cutting prices on Gonal-F.
That's the essence of the deal. Regulatory capital exchanged for fulfilling a policy promise.
How did patient groups and Democrats react?
Patient advocates like ASRM and Resolve called it an important first step. But they immediately stressed, you know, what's really needed is mandatory insurance coverage for IVF to create real access.
And Democrats.
They pretty much dismissed it as a half measure, pointing out it falls way short of the campaign pledge Trump made to make IVF completely free.
Okay, so that's healthcare. Shifting gears to energy policy, more unilateral action there, too.
Yes, definitely doubling down on the administration's energy dominance agenda. Also on October 16th, the Department of Energy finalized a really big loan guarantee.
How big?
$1.6 billion, with a B, to AEP Transmission.
American Electric Power subsidiary.
Right. And the money is for upgrading almost 5,000 miles of transmission lines across five states: Indiana, Michigan, Ohio, Oklahoma, and West Virginia.
Okay, 5,000 miles. That's a massive upgrade. What's the stated purpose?
The official line is enhancing grid reliability and capacity. Specifically, they're pointing to the need to meet soaring electricity demand from things like data centers and AI development.
But the policy context here is important, isn't it? AEP's energy sources.
Absolutely. Critical context. AEP primarily generates power from coal, natural gas, and nuclear. So this loan, which is the first one under the administration's renamed Energy Dominance Financing Program, very clearly reinforces the commitment to traditional energy sources, and notably in states that are politically significant.
And this loan stands in pretty stark contrast to some recent cancellations of energy funding, doesn't it?
A very sharp contrast, yes. Just recently, the administration canceled $7.6 billion in grants. These were for 223 clean energy projects across 16 states.
And those 16 states had something in common.
They all voted for Democrat Kamala Harris in the last election. The cancellations included up to $1.2 billion for California's Hydrogen Hub project.
So reward traditional energy in friendly states, cancel clean energy in opposition states. How did the Energy Secretary justify this difference?
Energy Secretary Chris Wright tried to draw a distinction. He defended canceling a different huge loan guarantee, $4.9 billion, for the Grand Belt Express line, which was meant for solar and wind energy, by calling that project a commercial enterprise the government shouldn't back.
But he was fine backing the AEP transmission upgrade.
He said he was happy to move forward with the AEP loan, even though that one was also conditionally approved under the previous administration. Critics are obviously pointing out the difference seems to be political alignment, not commercial viability.
Okay. Before we move off the 16th, there was also a quick immigration fee update.
Yes. Relatively minor, but part of the package. DHS issued a notice implementing a new $1,000 immigration parole fee. This was actually mandated by that H.R. 1 reconciliation bill we talked about earlier.
Got it. So required by law. Now, moving to today, October 17th, we saw a mix of symbolism and more punitive infrastructure politics.
Yeah, starting with the symbolism. President Trump unveiled the plans and models for his proposed Independence Arch.
Which he's calling the...
The Arc de Trump.
Okay. And the plan is to build this where?
Across from the Lincoln Memorial, near Arlington National Cemetery. It's tied to the upcoming 250th anniversary of the U.S. in 2026.
And who was at this unveiling?
It was revealed at a dinner with major supporters and financial backers, including, interestingly, representatives from big tech companies, Microsoft, Meta, Google, Amazon. They're also reportedly helping fund a separate project, the construction of a new White House ballroom.
Hmm. Okay, so symbolism on one hand, on the other, using federal power against political opponents, specifically New York City.
Exactly. The administration ordered a sudden halt to work on New York City's bus system. Just stopped it.
And the immediate reaction.
Zoran Mamdani, who's the front runner in the NYC mayoral race, just ripped into the order. He immediately framed it as political retaliation.
And he cited past examples.
Yes, he pointed out the administration previously cut funding to the city's education system over disputes about policies related to transgender students' bathroom access, things like that.
And there were direct threats tied to his potential election.
Mamdani said the president explicitly threatened to withhold federal money from the city if Mamdani wins the mayoral election, accusing him of making, quote, fake communist promises.
Wow. So it's creating this really clear pattern, isn't it? Federal resources, whether it's infrastructure loans, energy grants, transit funding, it's all being deployed based on political loyalty.
It certainly looks that way. Reward friends, punish enemies, whether it's states, cities, or specific projects.
And that pattern of control, that desire for loyalty, it extends right into the federal bureaucracy itself, right? Which brings us to maybe one of the biggest moves of the week, reshaping the workforce.
Absolutely. This is huge. Today, October 17th, President Trump signed an executive order titled Ensuring Continued Accountability in Federal Hiring.
And this order basically does what?
It fundamentally restructures how people get hired into the federal government. It moves away from the traditional merit-based system towards a much more politically centralized vetting process.
This sounds like the concerns people had about Schedule F or something similar, undermining the Pendleton Act.
That's exactly the comparison critics are making. It's seen as a systematic attempt to politicize the civil service, undermining the principles of the Pendleton Act from way back in 1883.
Okay, break down the mechanics. How does it actually work? What new bodies are created?
The core mechanism is this. Every single executive agency now has to create a strategic hiring committee.
And this committee's job?
Its job is to approve every single vacant or new position before it can be filled. Every single one.
And who sits on these committees? Career officials?
No, and that's the crucial part. The order mandates, they are composed primarily of political appointees, typically the agency's deputy head and the chief of staff people whose jobs depend directly on the administration.
So political loyalists are approving every single hire across the government.
Pretty much. And it goes further. Agencies also have to create annual staffing plans that align directly with the administration's stated priorities.
Yeah.
So it's not just vetting individual hires, it's shaping the entire workforce composition based on political goals.
This sounds like that pincer movement strategy people were worried about.
That's exactly how critics are describing it. Use the shutdown as cover for reductions in force RIFs to get rid of existing career staff you don't like, maybe labeling them disloyal or inefficient.
Okay, use the RIF to push people out.
And then use this new executive order, these strategic hiring committees, to control who comes in. Ensuring new hires are vetted for political alignment, not just competence.
So you control the exits and the entrances,
yeah.
Effectively bypassing the merit system established to prevent a spoil system.
That's the fundamental concern, yes. Shifting the focus from expertise proven through competitive exams to, well, political reliability.
Are there any exemptions, any jobs not covered by this?
Yes, there are exemptions. The order specifically excludes positions related to national security, public safety, and immigration enforcement. those areas bypass this new centralized political approval.
Okay. Now, speaking of those RAFs, those planned layoffs during the shutdown, the administration hit a roadblock there, didn't they? A legal one.
A significant one, yes. Today, a U.S. district judge in California, Judge Susan Ilston, granted a temporary restraining order, a TRO.
Blocking what specifically?
Blocking the administration from going ahead with over 4,000 planned layoffs of federal workers during the shutdown.
Okay, on what legal grounds? Why can't they lay people off during a shutdown?
This is fascinating. The unions argued, successfully for now, that the RIFs weren't just politically motivated, but they also violated the Anti-Deficiency Act.
The Anti-Deficiency Act? How does that apply to layoffs?
Because the act prohibits federal agencies from obligating funds they don't have. The unions argued that laying people off triggers a legal requirement to pay severance. But during a shutdown, agencies technically don't have appropriated funds to obligate for that severance pay.
So the judge agreed that they couldn't legally fire people because they couldn't legally promise the severance pay required.
Exactly. Judge Ilston found the administration seemed to be trying to use the shutdown, the lack of funds, as an excuse to terminate employees without following the proper procedures, which include securing funds for severance. It's a clever legal argument.
And this sets a pretty important precedent for future shutdowns, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It puts a legal check on using a funding lapse as a backdoor way to purge the workforce based on politics. If you want to do RIFs, you have to follow the rules, including funding severance, even if the government is partially shut down.
But the administration isn't just accepting this ruling, are they? I saw something about the Interior Department's response.
Right. Interior filed a response in court today, basically trying to minimize the ruling's impact. They admitted they were planning to carry out layoffs imminently if the judge hadn't stopped them.
But they argued the order only protected certain workers.
Yes, they tried to argue the TRO only blocked layoffs for union employees.
Ah, the loophole.
Exactly. They implied they might still try to move forward with layoffs for non-union staff, claiming those cuts are part of some pre-existing plan, totally unrelated to the shutdown.
So, still determined to shrink the workforce, even with judicial hurdles.
It certainly seems that way, pushing every legal boundary.
Okay, beyond personnel, we also saw some regulatory moves today. At the Patent Office, USPTO.
Yes, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office proposed some new rules regarding its Patent Trial and Appeal Board, the PTUTE. It involves revisions and also withdrawing some previous rules.
And the bottom line implication of these PTU changes?
The takeaway seems to be a clear move to make it significantly harder to challenge the validity of existing patents through that administrative PTA process.
Why is that significant? Who benefits?
Well, the PTA was often seen as a faster, cheaper way for, say, tech companies or generic drug makers to challenge weak patents held by competitors. Making it harder to use PTA strengthens the hand of current patent holders. That's generally seen as favorable for large pharmaceutical companies and established tech firms with big patent portfolios.
Okay. And one last point on the workforce and government functions, the IRS situation. That brain drain seems to be getting worse.
It's really concerning. Since January, the reporting indicates more than 170 IRS attorneys have withdrawn from active tax court cases. Dozens have just left the agency entirely.
170 attorneys. That's a lot of expertise walking out the door.
It's catastrophic, frankly. These aren't just any lawyers. They're specialists who understand incredibly complex corporate tax shelters, international tax law, multi-billion-dollar disputes. Losing them slows down litigation massively.
And weakens the government's ability to actually enforce the tax code.
Absolutely. Experts are saying this attrition is going to lead directly to more settlements in the taxpayers' favor than would normally happen.
Meaning corporations and wealthy individuals are more likely to win or get better deals because the IRS just doesn't have the expert staff to fight them effectively.
That's the unavoidable consequence. It undermines enforcement, potentially costs the Treasury billions, and raises serious questions about the fairness of the tax system long term. So that brings us back to the judiciary's role. We saw them pushing back on the RIFs. What about on other domestic executive actions, like using the military inside the U.S.?
Right. Big developments there. In Portland, Oregon, that TRO blocking the deployment of National Guard troops for federal law enforcement, that was extended yesterday, right?
Yes. U.S. District Judge Corinne Emmerich extended it for another 14 days on October 16th.
And her reasoning was grounded in?
State sovereignty, the 10th Amendment. She basically reaffirmed that the president can't just deploy military forces for domestic policing without the state's consent. This was especially pointed because The administration had tried to get around her first order by bringing in guard units from other states, like California and Texas.
So, firm judicial check on using the military domestically in that case.
A very significant one, yes.
But a similar fight over deploying the guard in Chicago is now heading to the Supreme Court.
It is, and very quickly. The administration wants to send hundreds of National Guard members to the Chicago area, again for federal law enforcement tied to immigration. The lower courts, including the Seventh Circuit Appeals Court, blocked it.
So the administration filed an emergency application with SCOTUS today?
Correct, October 17th. The Solicitor General, D. John Sauer, is making the case.
What's his argument?
He's arguing the lower court injunctions improperly interfere with presidential authority, Article II powers, and that they endanger federal personnel who are facing what the administration calls violent resistance while enforcing immigration laws.
But the state and city are fighting this hard.
Fiercely. Governor Pritzker of Illinois called it an unconstitutional invasion. He and Chicago officials sued, arguing there's simply insufficient evidence of the kind of rebellion or insurrection that might legally justify deploying the military domestically like this, even giving the president deference.
So the Supreme Court is being asked to step in and pause the block while the legal merits get sorted out.
Exactly. It's a major test of presidential power versus state sovereignty and judicial review in a domestic security context.
It's interesting, though, to contrast this lower court resistance on domestic military deployment with the Supreme Court's stance on immigration policy itself.
That's a crucial point, because earlier this month, remember, the Supreme Court issued that unsigned order in Noem v. National TPS Alliance.
Right, the temporary protected status case.
And in that case, the Supreme Court allowed the Trump administration to move forward with terminating TPS for hundreds of thousands of Venezuelan nationals, basically overruling a lower court block.
So the judicial check seems inconsistent. Lower courts pushing back on domestic military use and workforce actions, but the Supreme Court deferring more to the executive on immigration policy.
It certainly highlights the different levels of deference and the specific legal questions involved. The judiciary isn't a monolith here.
And while the courts are grappling with these big constitutional questions, what about the basic system for ethical oversight? Is that holding up?
Well, it seems to be under immense strain, possibly even direct attack. The watchdog group Common Cause filed a huge batch of ethics complaints, 54 of them, just in the last couple of days.
54 complaints? About what?
Citing violations across the board. The Hatch Act, for using government resources for political messaging. The Anti-Deficiency Act, related to spending and those RIF severance issues. And the Anti-Lobbying Act, for telling the public how to vote or pressure Congress.
And Common Cause is saying the system itself is failing.
Yes, they made a really interesting point. They said the current oversight system, things like inspector generals, the Office of Special Counsel, it's fragmented, it's outdated. It was designed more to catch hidden fraud, you know, secret deals.
Not designed for
this kind of open, coordinated, systematic political messaging being directed straight from the White House across the entire executive branch.
Like those website banners and emails blaming the shutdown on Democrats.
Exactly. OMB directives literally told agencies to put banners on their public websites and change their standard out-of-office email replies to say the shutdown was caused by radical left Democrats. That kind of overt politicization of the entire federal apparatus is precisely what the Hatch Act was meant to prevent.
And there were even reports of watchdog websites being down, making it hard to file complaints.
Yes, that was deeply concerning. In several instances, agency inspector general websites, the very place you'd go to report waste, fraud, or abuse, were reportedly inaccessible.
Which suggests?
Well, it strongly suggests the possibility of intentional interference, disabling the accountability mechanisms just when they might be needed most.
Okay, let's shift gears now to the international stage. A lot happening there too, especially involving Russia, Ukraine, and Venezuela.
A huge amount, yes. Starting with Russia and Ukraine. On October 16th, President Trump had that long phone call with President Putin.
2 hours, reportedly, aimed at restarting peace talks.
That was the stated goal. Trump came out of it sounding quite positive, described it as very productive. He projected real optimism about getting a deal done to end the war.
And there are plans for follow-up meetings.
Yes. Trump announced he intends to meet Putin in person in Budapest, Hungary, probably within the next 2 weeks.
Budapest, okay. And before that?
Before the principals meet, there's a plan for top U.S. and Russian officials to meet next week. The U.S. delegation is notably going to be led by Secretary of State Marco Rubio, trying to lay the groundwork.
Okay, so movement on the Russia front. Then today, October 17th, Trump met with Ukrainian President Zelensky at the White House. What was the key issue there?
A major topic was weaponry, specifically Ukraine's long-standing request for long-range Tomahawk cruise missiles.
And how did Trump respond to that request?
He seemed pretty hesitant, maybe even dismissive. His reported comments were that it's not easy for the U.S. to just give away massive numbers of very powerful weapons. He implied the U.S. needs to keep its own stockpiles.
So no Tomahawks for now.
It seems that way. Zelensky, trying to put a positive spin on it, said after the meeting that the topic wasn't canceled, just that it required more work. Which is usually diplomatic code for, I didn't get what I asked for, but I'm still trying.
And did Trump and Zelensky agree on Putin's intention? Whether he actually wants peace?
No. They offered pretty conflicting views, actually. Trump, based on his Putin call, projected optimism, suggesting Moscow is serious about making a deal.
But others are skeptical.
Yes. Figures like General Wesley Clark suggested Putin might just be playing on Trump's known desire to make a big deal. And that any Russian flexibility is probably due to the pressure of the ongoing war, maybe even the implicit threat of Ukraine eventually getting those Tomahawks.
Okay, so Ukraine diplomacy is complex. Meanwhile, things seem to be heating up militarily near Venezuela.
Dangerously so, yes. The U.S. is definitely escalating its military campaign against what it calls drug trafficking vessels off the Venezuelan coast. There's a large U.S. military presence, about 10,000 forces maintained in the Caribbean.
And there was another strike recently.
Yes. A strike on Thursday targeted a vessel Trump described as a drug-carrying submarine. Two people were killed in that strike.
But this one was different somehow.
Yes. Crucially, this was the first reported strike in this campaign where there were survivors. Two individuals were reportedly detained and are being held on a U.S. Navy ship. Before this, there had been five strikes reported, killing 27 people with no known survivors.
And this military action is paired with tougher rhetoric and covert ops.
Definitely. Trump confirmed earlier this week he'd authorized the CIA to expand covert operations inside Venezuela. And today, he used some very blunt language, warning Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro not to, quote, F around with the U.S. Very direct threat.
This level of escalation must be causing concern in Congress.
It is. A bipartisan group of senators led by Democrat Tim Kaine and Republican Rand Paul announced they're going to force a vote on a war powers resolution.
Aimed at
blocking the use of U.S. military force within or against Venezuela without explicit congressional approval. They're invoking Congress's constitutional role in declaring war, arguing for deliberation before potentially sliding into conflict.
Okay, one final major item from these 2 days, the John Bolton indictment.
Right. Huge news. On October 16th, a federal grand jury in Maryland indicted Bolton, the former national security advisor.
On what charges?
18 counts, mostly related to improperly retaining and transmitting national defense information after he left office. He pleaded not guilty to all charges today, Friday the 17th.
And the specific allegations involved?
They stem from allegations that he sent classified diary-like entries about his time in the White House to two relatives using personal email, and also that he kept classified records unsecured at his home in Maryland.
Now, the political context here is impossible to ignore, isn't it? Bolton is the third high-profile Trump critic indicted recently.
That's exactly. Following former FBI Director Jim Comey and New York Attorney General Letitia James, all indicted within less than a month, it inevitably raises questions about political motivation.
How are people viewing the motive? Is it pure politics or is there substance?
Well, you have sharply conflicting views. Democratic Congressman Jamie Raskin called it straight-up revenge for Bolton's very public criticism of Trump.
But others see legal merit?
Yes. Ty Cobb, who used to be a White House lawyer for Trump, offered a more nuanced take. He said the prosecution was clearly not based only on revenge, arguing the underlying case likely has real legal merit regarding the handling of classified information.
But he conceded.
He conceded it probably wouldn't have been brought without Trump's desire for retribution.
Yeah.
So maybe legally justifiable, but politically targeted.
And the FBI director, Kash Patel, confirmed there was an investigation.
Yes. Patel confirmed the charges followed an FBI probe that allegedly found Bolton transmitted top secret information using personal online accounts. So there seems to be a factual basis alleged. Even if the timing and target feel political, it really captures the blending of law and politics in this moment.
Okay, let's try to pull these threads together. Synthesizing the last, 48 hours or so, what are the big takeaways?
I think the clearest trend is the sheer ascendancy of the executive branch. It's using the legislative paralysis caused by the shutdown as an opportunity to govern by other means.
Through unilateral action, through these transactional policies we discussed.
Exactly. We saw it in the IVF deal policy achieved not through legislation, but through a specific deal trading regulatory relief for price cuts. We saw it in the AEP energy loan unilateral direction of huge funds towards preferred industries and allies.
And we saw it in the civil service executive order, a direct unilateral attempt to reshape the government's workforce based on political loyalty.
Right. But this executive push isn't going unchallenged, at least not domestically. The judiciary is actively intervening.
Pushing back significantly, yeah. Blocking the shutdown RAFs based on the Anti-Deficiency Act argument about severance pay.
And really digging in its heels on the domestic deployment of the National Guard in places like Portland and Chicago, asserting state sovereignty and judicial review, even as the judicial branch itself is facing this existential funding crisis.
And all of this is playing out against the backdrop of intense strain on the federal workforce itself.
Absolutely. You have this stark contrast.
Yeah.
Select law enforcement getting paid through these extraordinary budget tricks, while thousands of other civilian employees face real financial hardship.
Compounded by the anxiety over future healthcare costs rising sharply and the knowledge that the merit-based system they rely on is being systematically chipped away at by things like that hiring EO.
So what these 2 days, October 16th and 17th, really showcase is this fundamental shift. Policy isn't being made through negotiation and compromise in Congress anymore, at least not right now. It's being achieved through the strategic, sometimes aggressive, assertion of executive power against a deadlocked legislature and a judiciary that's fighting back but also struggling.
Which leaves us with a final thought, a question really, for you, the listener, to consider. In this kind of environment defined by selective payments, political hiring controls, policy by deal, what's the ultimate cost? What's the price of this gridlock and executive dominance on the stability, the independence of America's core institutions? Especially when the systems designed for oversight and accountability seem to be weakening, or maybe even being deliberately dismantled. Something to think about as these conflicts inevitably continue.